am a professor of humanities in Christ College at Valparaiso University. If my voice sounds a little bit quavery, it's only because after I ate early supper and was boldly introduced by Walt Bowman with a thumbs up approach, he also said very indirectly, and I take it this is the way they mortify human beings here at Holden, he said, we were having troubles with the dish teams, and we'd like you to look and see when you are up. And so my wife said, why don't you take a little peek? And so I peeked, and sure enough, we were up. So as we speak about the arts, I have the smell of the scullery.
It's not supposed to work that way.
It was a little different. I remember as a student one time hearing in St. Louis that some of the best art and some of the best Gregorian chant in the Western world was available at a little Benedictine monastery in St. Meinrad's, Indiana. So I took a hitchhiked over there with a buddy and spent a weekend at this particular monastery, and it truly was very beautiful. They had a Benedictine come over from Belgium named Gregory DeWitt, and he had decorated the entire ceiling of the chapter house with a little bit more confined space than Rich Kemmerer had. And the Gregorian chant was absolutely marvelous. And the monks had returned from studying Bach in Leipzig for a good number of years. So it was a superb experience. But one of the most shattering experiences was to discover that the Father Abbot would come into your room before you would retire, and he would ask for your shoes, which he would polish, and he'd bring you a can of beer, or a bottle of beer at that time. And at the breakfast table, as you were eating, the professors in the seminary part of the monastery would serve at the table. Now, I never went as far as to press the father whether the profs also worked in the scullery, which I think would have been very healthy for all. The fact is that the Benedictines, Luther's famous and favorite group, were known for their contribution and love of the arts and their sustaining it in our Western world. If I have any credentials for speaking to you and with you this evening, I would prefer not to lecture. What I thought I would try to do is to sketch out rapidly a number of possible ways in which we could move and elicit from the group and from our own experience ways in which the arts really contribute to the deepening and enlarging of our understanding of the Christian faith. And I thought I might do it by quickly indicating how, as I listened to the different presentations this week, been here 2 days, and even this morning, I was struck by the fact that the question of the relationship between the artist and the community and the arts came up, if not explicitly, almost at every turning point in the conversation. For example, this morning in the prayer session, we were following the LBW devotions from year two. I've been following year one all along and found myself out of joint with this. But it was interesting that the gospel that was meditated on, Matthew 16, deals with the expensive, wasteful ointment that Mary Magdalene, as she is called elsewhere by tradition, excessively pours over Jesus' feet. There's an immediate response from the disciples taking exception to the fact that she has done this, and then he makes that statement, what she has done is a beautiful act, and then the very difficult statement which we discussed, the poor you always have with you, but she has done this as a memorial to me, and wherever this gospel is read, we'll remember this particular act of this woman, this wasteful act, which the money could have been given to the poor. And we immediately got off into some of the most fundamental conflicts and problems that have surrounded the relationship between the Christian faith and the arts since the inception of the church. It's something that recurs, and immediately there were responses to what do you do when you have to choose between a really good organ in a congregation and a weaker one? How do you account for the fact that the institution seems often to serve itself with the very nature of its love and display of the beautiful? Or we had even spoken of the book of Joshua. And Joshua is, I'm sure, a modern politician who's interested in the dramatic, symbolic elements that leaders use. As you read and hear that passage, you can't help but be struck by the fact that since Moses is gone, the real question is a kind of crisis of legitimacy in the people of Israel. And fortunately for Joshua, he seems to have people who know how to dramatize the need for real legitimacy. The Ark of the Covenant moves 1,000 yards ahead of the people of Israel, moves through the Jordan, and the Jordan banks all raise up. They find their 12 stones, and we have this tremendous sense that the people of Israel is being revisited by a new leader in the same way as they had the leadership under Moses. And somebody in the audience responded and said, "Ah, these people, obviously, we have to say, they always have to have a visible presence of some guarantee, some sign." Our leader said, "some symbol of the presence of God in the life of the worshiping and following community." So wherever you go, you hear references to it. A little later, I wasn't able to attend some of the other sessions. I noticed that in the book of Isaiah, quite obviously, here is a poet who sings of justice, and the jibing of justice and beauty certainly come together in this marvelous, literate, courtly advising poet of the Old Testament. Later on, Mark Twain referred to, I suppose, our kind of iconoclastic artist in our own day, although I must admit, I've gone to see Annie Hall. My wife and I missed Manhattan recently. We just simply couldn't get there, but it's true. Woody Allen does speak to our deep crises, our cynicism, our understanding. For me, one of his favorite shots in Annie Hall is when he's carrying what has become one of my favorite books in the last few years and favorite author, Ernest Becker's, what is it? Anyone recall? No, it's the Dial of Death. He carries it with him everywhere in the stores. It's a paperback he's reading. It's a marvelous study of the significance of the feeling and tension that all of us as living Americans have before the presence of the end, and how we must live out our vital lives in order to survive. And he is richly embedded in the Christian, particularly the Kierkegaardian tradition. Woody Allen does spend a great deal of time reading these works, and he resonates, and his movies resonate to the kinds of theological questions that are raised by the film. And in this case, as Mr. Schwein pointed out very quickly, the film itself raises the fundamental question of trust in the contemporary world. And I guess our question might be, as Christians, does that trust come from the film, or does the film primarily raise the question of trust? But anyone who's seen the films or enjoyed the delight of what it means simply to work with the various artistic media knows that to talk about the arts from a Christian perspective is a complicated, very detailed, but delightful opportunity. And so we titled the possibilities tonight as basically a sounding, a kind of probing, a probing which I thought, if we're going to start any place, why don't we start with a man like Martin Luther, with all of the strengths and all of the limitations of our own tradition in its approach to the arts. Because I think Lutherans, by and large, have been known primarily for the musical arts, and possibly in the contemporary world for architecture, and maybe for some great and distinguished painters. But we don't have that same kind of immersion in the arts that we associate with some other traditions. But it's interesting that Luther, as you might guess, was very sensitive to this particular problem. And I've run across occasional quotes to a letter of his to another poet. When the Reformation was going on, one of the great questions was, will the Reformation lead, because of certain kinds of iconoclastic, image-breaking tendencies in the church, and the desire for a kind of worship in simplicity and truth, will this lead to a crude, barbarous outbreak in the culture of the times? And the poets of the time, even those who had become Reformation believers, were very sensitive to this particular kind of issue, as was Philip Melanchthon and a few other reformers of the time. And they ask, Luther, Eobin Hess, one of the poets, wrote a long poem, 428 verses, titled Captiva, in which he more or less praises Luther for all he's doing, and then in a little accompanying note, tried to ask, well, what's going to be the future of the finer cultural elements in human life now that the Reformation is underway? And let me quote from the little reply that Luther gives. He says, grace and peace to you. Your delightful letter was given me by a good friend. And our friend Philip Melanchthon showed it to me. He says, perhaps this ought to be enough for the rude Luther to write to you, my dear Eobin, merely as an acknowledgement of your letter. For what should I write besides? I who wish to read nothing that is not worthy of your muse, even though I know the sincerity of your heart and that you do not despise things of smaller worth. What I think of the Captiva, your poem, you can judge for yourself, for you are not of such hard fiber as not to perceive, and not so conceited as to flatter yourself that you have surpassed even yourself. In one thing, however, you will not surpass yourself. You will not get yourself to believe that the Captiva displeases either me or you. It will be published soon, and even without us, it will show what sort of man its author is, and it will not need to fear envy herself. But unless I knew that you would say you had done it for propriety's sake, I should protest that too much has been ascribed to my name in this remarkable little poem. Before the mass media, obviously. Give to others, says the poet, the honor of this name. Still, I will bear this undeserved glory, for I have grown accustomed to bearing deserved ignominy. Obviously, he was praised, and he needed that praise at this particular moment in the work of the Reformation. So he accepted it, as we all accept Holden, as a gift. Do not be disturbed by the fears which you express that our theology will make us Germans more barbarous in letters. I accept all the Scandinavians who are here this evening, of course, than we have ever been. He says, some people often have their fears when there is nothing to fear. Now, the next passage I read to you is the passage that is always quoted, or I should say usually quoted, when people are talking about Christians who are Lutherans who are interested in the arts, or who ought to be interested in the arts. Here's the way it goes. He says, I am persuaded that without knowledge of literature, pure theology cannot at all endure. Just as heretofore, when letters have declined and lain prostrate, theology too has wretchedly fallen and lain prostrate. Nay, I see that there has never been a great revelation of the Word of God unless he has first prepared the way by the rise and prosperity of languages and letters as though they were John the Baptist. There is indeed nothing that I have less wish to see done against our young people than they should be required not to study poetry and rhetoric. Certainly, it is my desire that there shall be as many poets and rhetoricians as possible, because I see that by these studies, as by no other means, people are wonderfully fitted for the grasping of sacred truth and for handling it skillfully and happily. It's an interesting kind of statement, and it ends with Luther saying, I wish I could do more of the reading and the poetry. We know, for example, at this time that he had received a copy of Homer, and he was reading Homer a great deal. We also know that if we look through his writings at this time, there are a lot of quotes from Homer. He then obviously gave the book to Philip Melanchthon, and there are no more quotes from Homer in the later Luther's works. The fact is, though, that he was extremely sensitive on the relationship between the Christian faith and the arts. He saw them, I suppose, in our own terms, as a kind of vital and necessary catalyst. Without the arts, as John Keats would argue later on in the 19th century, you know, truly, what is greater, truth or the flight of an eagle? And John Keats says, quite obviously, truth. But, he says, what is truth to the one who knows the flight of the eagle and sees truth as the flight of the eagle? For what do the arts do? They keep alive in the human community the significance and vitality of the faith which we hold. And I suppose if we were looking for some way of working with the way in which a Lutheran can approach the arts, here's one way in which it could be sketched out and deepened. But I must qualify that quickly and say anyone who's thought about this will probably find that it does open up a whole series of possible approaches. So that when we look at the arts today, aside from the fact that they themselves are so highly specialized, there is also the tremendous sense of how rich are the possibilities of thinking about it from a Christian point of view. For what have you got? If we read the critics and those who talk about the arts, besides those who enjoy them as we do or perform them, but who turn their guns, so to speak, and we let the whole matter of the arts become momentarily the object of what we think about, what we discover as we look at the thinkers who think about the arts is that they're talking about the artist, the notion of genius, the importance of expression, or they're talking about the object, the work of art, how it's structured, how it's put together, what makes it the particular kind of artifact that evokes from us tremendous attention and concern, so much so that we can read a book, and as Mr. Eliotta has suggested, it's our way of going through an ancient ritual. When we read a book or go to a movie, what do? Momentarily, we abandon the world of the everyday, of time and space. We walk out of a movie on a sunny afternoon, and we're suddenly struck by which is the reality through which I've gone, this real world or the world I have simply experienced as a kind of ritual of experience of something beyond time and place. Or we can talk as the German theoreticians are so interested today in the whole notion of reception, of what happens in the reader. When you're a teacher, or when you're talking, or when you're reading, what is important? Is it the value of the reader? And you're a teacher, say, and you know everything about the history and the context and the structure of the work, and you're watching this young person suddenly become electrified by a poem. And what you also observe is it's a terrible misreading of the poem. And it has no connection at all with the intention of the author, nor with the context, nor the history of the particular kind of poem. But it has opened up momentarily the entire value consciousness, the sensate world of the student. Where do you step in? Or do you step in? That's why even the reader becomes one of the primary focuses for the Christian. Or, more seriously, for those of us who go to movies or read novels, the fact is there's always a world or a faith which is represented, which is imitated, which is rendered. What is the relationship between the work that is there and our experience? Does it jive? In fact, what is our grasp of reality in relationship to the work, which may upset that momentarily, or which may intensify it for a long time, or which may deepen our understanding in ways that we had not considered? All right? Reader, work, artist, world. Here we are as Christians, having used our eyes and our ears and our senses most of our life long. Remember, W.H. Auden made that very severe comment one time when he was asked, what do you feel about your poems and the way in which they are written and read? And he said, well, it's a very difficult thing, because at one time before a college audience, a young student had asked him, for whom do you write, Mr. Auden? Because some of your poems are rather difficult to understand. And he looked at him and he said, I have written for people who've been dead for hundreds of years. and another occasion, he made a very, very volatile and serious retort, because he said, you know, to learn how simply to receive is a difficult thing. And then what happens for most of us is, as Kant was quick to follow out, we don't usually wait too long to both receive and to interpret, and quickly we come in with judgments. So our initial response usually is, I don't like it, I do like it, and we begin usually with a value judgment. Well, this kind of experience on Auden's part made him say one time, I guess he was quoting an 18th century wit, you can't expect a jackass to look into the Holy Scriptures and find an angel looking back out. It was one of his most severe statements about the problem of the reader in relationship to a text. But it was, I think, an impatient one on his part. All of these suggest, of course, the richness and possibility, because we have been reared and we've been making judgments and we've been interpreting, one of the most difficult and learned skills, and we have our particular kinds of responses. And we have also the comforting knowledge that the good theoreticians will tell us is that often the naked or innocent eye, although there are many who will say there is no such thing as a naked and innocent eye, at least the untutored, because they can look at language and imagery and metaphor fresh, can come at a text or a painting or a piece of sculpture, and their response can be as invigorating and enlivening and can enlarge the very tradition of accumulated response that you and I are fortunate to have in our own time. Okay. Let me rehearse what I've done. I've just tried to sketch out very rapidly some of the ways in which we could go at the question of our experience of the role of the arts in our Christian faith. The next step would be to say, suppose we make a sounding out of our own experience and try to cope with one question, a question I'm sure many of you have rehearsed and gone through before. What do you see as the role of the arts? Now, I realize we're on a high kind of level of generality. Most of us are going to respond to a specific art or even a specific artist or even a specific piece. But the fact is that we can, I think, beginning there, begin to say something about what the role of the arts has been in our own life as worshiping, meditating, reflective Christians. And I thought it would be fun to see if we can, out of this particular group, come to a series of insights on the kinds of contributions we would see the arts making to our common Christian life. After all, we have a rich, rich culture to draw on. Any suggestions?
We seem to depend largely upon education, which is a series of courses which have lectures, examinations, and grades to provide this background of the arts. Doesn't do so. I'm very skeptical, having been in the game for nearly 50 years. I'm very skeptical of it. I think that when you put the arts on parade and say, this is a lesson that you have to learn, that you are in danger of just blacking them out for a great many people. And that is a serious problem. Yeah, you spoke of wanting more time of the audience under pressure to make a judgment. If anybody is under pressure to make a judgment, it's the students in our classes.
Now, I suppose out of fairness, because each of us will speak out of our own autobiographies to this particular kind of question, it might be well for us to identify ourselves and indicate something of our reasons for saying what we have to say. I'm thinking, for example...
I'm a retired professor of English from the University of Texas.
All right.
And I have watched the students for, as I say, nearly 50 years, and in my old age, I'm very skeptical about the success we have, because what do they do when they graduate with a BA or an MA or a PhD? Do they read books avidly? No.
Well, could we counter and ask this question? Those of you who teach in elementary school or on the secondary level, would you agree with a professor from Texas that this is what you observe about the young coming out of our American educational cultural system? There we go.
I would like to speak as a prospective professor. And I've had now my first series of freshmen as students this year. And I teach like intro lit, right, things like that. So this is the first time supposedly they're looking at the genres and things like that. And I've had numerous students report to me that they never read anything but textbooks, and have said at the end of quarters and after grading conferences and everything else that they're really excited about learning that there are ways to approach literature that makes it approachable to them, and that they intend to read more and now find that poetry or drama or even novels they haven't been reading look like something they do want to read, and that they do see hope for relating their own experience to the experience they have in reading. So I don't think it's quite that hopeless.
I remember a librarian I knew once had a little placard in his office. It was a quotation from a Southern Black. And it said, when I works hard. When I sets loose. When I reads, I goes to sleep. And, you know, whether this is a universal judgment we have to make on our own culture is, of course, one thing that's been explored and reported on variety of ways, but certainly here we have a little bit more hopeful response, and at least for the younger teacher who is coming up and seeing, after all, here's what happens on the freshman level in the liberal arts setting. The students do see ways of opening up their experience. But it was my impression that in good elementary school education, the notion of story, of the human body, of the love of life and the love of words. We know, for example, what happens to young people at 12 or 13 when they stop enjoying being read to, or they stop reading stories which disturb and arouse the imagination. Is this simply an experience in our culture that happens with adolescence? I was hoping that we'd have people who've had a much richer experience than the young this way.
I would like to say I have taught first grade for over 30 years, or taught, I should say, over 30 years, and I've taught first grade many years, and I can see a swinging of the pendulum back to better literature, better storybooks for children, and also a better interest by the parents. I would say in the last 5 years, I can see a difference. And it's really encouraging.
I'd like to report a different kind of experience, and that's that I teach in an inner city school in Los Angeles, where I find extreme lack of knowledge of lots of types of the arts, lots of backgrounds, and I feel very bad, and I teach high school. I feel very badly that many of the people on faculty, our kids have low skill levels, so the reading is really pretty bad, but I find that they are expected to read comic books because they can read those, and they're not really pushed to even so they know that literature is out there, they're not even given that. And I find that very disturbing. And in my own experiences, I teach music there. I've introduced them to different things that they've never seen before. We took them to a symphony last. They had never been heard of a symphony. And it was just, it was wonderful. But it's a real slow process, because it's like this has not happened from elementary school.
Here we go. Up here.
There's an interesting program called the RITA program, whereby reading is being taught through the visual arts. This was started in, I believe, Brooklyn, New York, in a high school there. And 1 year in the art classes where reading was taught, the students would achieve a full year of reading ability. Pardon me, I'm afraid I'm wrong on that. I think it's 6 months in the program they achieved a full year of reading ability. I have run a similar program with elementary students. We find that they become much more perceptive, they enjoy reading more, they enjoy school more. And I find it very helpful. And for anyone who's interested, I can maybe give you information on that.
Can I make just one more comment?
Sure.
There is a real tendency in Southern California schools to go back, there's a policy of going back to basics, and that's it, and knocking out lots of the arts, and I find it's a real fight to even say these are really, really worthwhile.
All right.
I think in a certain sense we really have a basic misunderstanding of human nature when we say that the arts are merely ornamental. I think they're fundamental to our human character. I mean, when we're talking about Stone Age cultures, and we think, you know, we teach in the social studies books that people were out there spending their 24 hours a day grabbing food, eating it, and sleeping so they could prepare to grab food and eat and sleep some more, and that they were at that that was essential already to have art. You know, that they made beautiful their clubs. They didn't just club with them, but they made them pretty.
All right, you have to go ahead, please.
I'm an elementary school principal, and I can see where. I agree with the gentleman from Texas. We're losing something. I think we're producing better books now for children. We have better teachers, more proficient teachers. Yet, in spite of this fact, I think when kids get into high school and college, we're missing the mark someplace. And I don't know precisely where. I think we're fairly successful in the elementary school, but I'm prejudiced too.
Nice. it's interesting how we have the tensions in our own culture here, because we see the problems and we're not so quite sure how to get at the problems. But let's go ahead.
Okay, I grew up on an Indian reservation, and I did some student teaching there. And we had children in first grade whose parents did not read, really did not read. And the children had never been read to, and some of them would not talk for many months after they came to school. Somehow, a child has to have an idea that this thing has value to him. And he has to have some value in his own culture, I think, before he can go over the bridge to a culture that is brought to him from some distance.
Okay. That suggests even a more difficult problem. We have one speaker here, then here, then here. All right? Go ahead.
I'm a pastor and a writer. I'm also from Texas. And I'll make reference to a book that was written about 15 or so years ago. I can't recall the author's name. You probably know. The Student as Nigger. And he brings out in that book the comparison to the term nigger that was used in the South, particularly for centuries, that the black person, the name of the game for him or her was survival. And if Massa thought that you walked the shovel, you walked the shovel. And if he thought you liked watermelon, you liked watermelon because you survived, and that was the name of the game, was to survive. The Student as Nigger is somewhat, has been somewhat in the same position in our American system of education. And that is, the name of the game is survival. And you survive, you don't pluck sandbox, you know, because you've got to get into first grade. And you do what is expected of you. And how many kids, even in my confirmation classes, the kids will openly ask me, what do you want me to say? You know, rather than, because they're geared to saying what that big person wants them to say, what they at least perceive that person wants them to say. And so the name of the game is survival. And how then can one introduce the arts and the more sophisticated kinds of things that we want them to learn as basics when they can scarcely survive even basic math?
If there were a Marxist in the crowd, he would leap to his feet or her feet immediately and point out how we, when we talk about the arts, are ourselves part of a much larger superstructure, which if they look back in the 19th century and they look at the problem of race in our country, are pretty sure that a culture does not wish its people to be literate, highly trained for inquiry, particularly critical. And so the books that were available and the things that have been made available tend to be the types that sustain a status quo support of the culture. All right.
I'm a high school guidance counselor, and one of my most challenging responsibilities is interpreting our curriculum and our curriculum requirements to students. And I say challenging mainly because many of our students will say, why do I have to take that course? Why do I have to take this one? And in a sense, I find a good deal of what the gentleman from Texas had mentioned, and that one of the big problems is we feel we would like to have the students appreciate the arts. And as a result, the curriculum is devised in such a way that we make these students take these things, and if it's a requirement, it's got to be bad. We require in our high school a course in a four-year period of time in a practical or a fine arts. And as soon as the kids find that practical art does include wood shop or auto mechanics or typing, they heave a sigh of relief because they don't have to take those old music courses or something of that nature, an art course. But the interesting thing is, we present a major musical production every spring. And there are students volunteering to get into this thing out of a true appreciation and a desire to perform. Now, that's not only the performers and the orchestra and the actors and actresses and the dancers and so on. That includes the carpentry students who are building the sets. And they create these things and are so proud of them. The art students who are doing the painting and the like. We also have some architectural drawing classes, and the very student who doesn't want to take an art class thrives on architectural drawing, and he's creating. And we hope that at least through the exposure, they will develop some kind of an appreciation, and we just keep our fingers crossed that that's the case.
All right. Professor of Chemistry now on the arts.
But I'm speaking from the perspective of a parent, not any professional perspective, but I've had some years of experience at the latter. It seemed to me, as my oldest two were going through high school, as far as the reading, which they were being asked to do, that somehow or other somebody had given up. Because as I looked at those books, I couldn't see that they were particularly well written as examples of the language and how it can be used. I didn't see that they presented any particularly valuable ideas and insights that might either be personally useful to the development of the student or informative of their cultural heritage. And the impression I got from talking with a few of the teachers is, well, they didn't give them books that were exciting, which I translate as gross, that they wouldn't read them at all. And some of them were books which my children didn't want to read because they weren't interested in anything that gross. As I look at my youngest, who just finished the fourth grade, he has gotten really turned on to the idea of poetry from some experience and writing some things themselves that illustrate various forms as well as putting words together. In music, I think we had one of the finest examples you could hope to have the last couple of evenings at Vespers of the approach that's used in school as well as church now, getting the children really involved, using rhythmic instruments, using body motions, really getting the whole being into it. And yet I wonder, in doing that, they are not again getting exposed, at least at that age, to the grandeur of the heritage of music of the past and adult music of the present. And yet when I hear the choirs of all of the public high schools around singing the finest sacred and secular music in superb performances, they're getting it. The ones that aren't able to participate because they aren't in the choirs, I suppose they have some chance to hear the choir and may in fact go because their friends are there, even if they aren't attracted intrinsically by what's going on. And so I'm not sure where we're coming out on all of that and at which level, elementary school, junior high, high school, we can expect to really be sharing with them what we consider the greatest achievements of the culture that is our heritage first, as well as other people's heritage, if they can appreciate that, and where you simply have to get their attention and engage them in something to bring them along.
Okay. Suppose we shift momentarily, because what we've discussed really are the problems in our culture and the relationship of the educational system, the whole development of young people and adults to the arts. But suppose we shift along the lines of the question of the relationship of your understanding of the arts to the Christian faith. Or to put it in a little bit different, or phrase it a little bit differently, what do the arts mean to you as a celebrating, living, suffering, reading, thinking, reflecting, meditating, anguishing Christian? Or what have they meant to you? Well,
the arts are my proof for the existence of God. And no, really. And the way they are is because they demonstrate two things. One is our unpredictability. That is our real openness. You can predict a spider's web, you cannot predict the next artistic creation. And the second thing is because they're reflective. What is uniquely human about us is our capacity to stand outside of ourselves and look at ourselves. The artists are the ones who do that. The arts do that. And it's where we are most human that we are therefore most reflective of God. And I think I said this before in this room, I have problems believing in God a lot of times, but never when I'm listening to the B minor Mass or reading a great poem or a great piece of literature.
Art is dead.
You mean like God is dead?
Art is dead.
Art is dead.
I think what art has given, an appreciation of art, has given me is a greater appreciation of the world and a greater joy in living in the world. A great happiness, really. No boredom.
Yes, even so ancient a man as Aristotle in the Poetics would say, you know, there's something beautiful about just simply running with your human body.
That's right.
Just simply feeling it, moving, and the very rhythms of
life.
It wasn't
until about 5 years ago I decided maybe I shouldn't be running anymore.
In other words, just the simple celebration, as we use the word probably too much, of what it means to be, is there as a kind of fundamental trust of being and of our world. But in the background I hear, art is dead. And that was, you know, right after our tremendous affirmation by our theologian in residence.
I think he needs to enlarge on that.
Sure. No, I think in one sense he is not in error. I think it has a tendency to kill at times. And the reason for it is the era in which I was raised, maybe I have a great appreciation for a given type of music or whatever there was. But my son can't stand the kind of music that I enjoy. He enjoys a different type of music. And if you go to church with him, you know, and you play nothing but that kind of music that I like, he's wanting to look for a different church because it turns him off. Okay, the point being then that I think that that we have a real problem, that we've got to look at all of the different sides. You know, for a pastor who gives a sermon, I wouldn't be a pastor for anything, you know, in a sense. You give a sermon in church on Sunday, and it's one person will walk up and say, greatest sermon you've ever preached, and the next one will walk up and say, you know, if you ever give another one like that, I won't be seen in the door. You know, I mean, in the sense that we're all at different places at the same time. And so I think art, in one sense, in terms of music within the church or whatever it may be, has it. It turns some off and some on. And so you got to do a little rotating or, you know, you don't make it.
I hate to cut the discussion here. It seems to me we're on the edge of where we should be at the beginning.
Same time tomorrow.
Tomorrow night.
Don't cut it, adjourn it.
Yeah.
tomorrow.
Adjourn it to the next meeting.
Okay.